In our gospel reading, because we are in Luke 20, this is the last week of Jesus' life. He's well aware. And the week kicked off by him entering into Jerusalem and essentially prophetically denouncing or condemning the temple. This is where he famously throws over the tables with all the money changers and all of that. And this has nothing to do with exchange rates. Not ultimately, anyway. It was meant to be a small action that had much bigger significance because the temple itself had been corrupt for a long time. And the average person even was well aware of this. It was functioning like a bank and dealing in bad faith loans and foreclosure crises and stuff like that, which is a weird thing for a temple to be doing. As you might imagine, the leaders of the temple were not thrilled by this. Not because a single person could disrupt the operation of the temple, that's just ludicrous, but because he was so popular and cut right to the heart of what they knew was going on, that they had a problem on their hands. Which is why, in our reading today, the Sadducees are approaching Jesus, trying to get him to say something dumb, something that they could trap him with. Because the Sadducees themselves, different from the Pharisees, were essentially the chief priests. So there's some gray area there. All Sadducees were priests, generally speaking, high ranking, and very wealthy. Very wealthy with a lot of power and influence. So, think state-sponsored televangelists or something like that. Like, kind of scummy, very untrustworthy, but really hard to touch. Now, as Luke also explains, they deny the resurrection of the dead. That was one of their beliefs that set them apart from the group, say, like the Pharisees. The Pharisees, very much a mixed bag. Some really supported Jesus, some did not. That aligns with the historical record. There was a split among them. And the Pharisees were very different because they believed the whole Bible, or what we would call the Hebrew Bible. But the Sadducees also only acknowledged the first five books, what we would call Torah, or the books of Moses, or the books of the law. It has a lot of names. But they didn't acknowledge, say, the prophets. I'm sure they had their theological reasons, so to speak, but the prophets tended to be pretty critical of the temple, so that tracks. We can justify anything. So when they approach Jesus and they ask him some crazy question about the resurrection of the dead, you immediately know that they are not asking in good faith. They are trying to come up with some ridiculous story about, a woman who is married to seven brothers, and then in the resurrection, which they don't even believe in, who she married to. Now, Jesus, for once, or at least on this is one of the rare times, Jesus gives them a straight answer. Most of the time, Jesus answers questions with a question, which is a good way to irritate people, but it's also a good way to get people to think. In this case, he just lays it out there. Now, his response is very layered, very complicated. It's the stuff that graduate students write, long, boring papers that only one person, their professor, reads. We're not going to go into that. We simply don't have the time to take a multidimensional approach to figuring out everything that Jesus is saying. That day may come. There's been a rumor that was started by somebody over there that at some point we will go through in my Bible study the entire book of Luke, which is my academic interest, but not yet, for reasons. But anyway, And when we do, we will go through this very, very layered. But what I want to do actually is focus specifically on this concept of resurrection. Because in church life, it's always floating around. We always think like, oh yeah, so Jesus was raised from the dead. That's why we celebrate Easter, and for some reason there's a bunny involved. actually, there's a very good reason that has Christian origins, not pagan, by the way. We'll talk about that during Christmas and Easter. But nonetheless, we don't often take a step back and say, yeah, but what does resurrection really mean? Because there's a lot of confusion about it. Sometimes if we talk about resurrection, it's like, well, okay, therefore we know that Jesus is the divine Son of God. A first century Jewish person would not have made that connection. Or we could say that Jesus, by being raised from the dead, like the check cleared that he paid with his body when he was crucified. No, I think that was completed when he died. So sometimes people will say, well, okay, Jesus was raised from the dead, therefore we know that we'll go to heaven when we die. Those ideas aren't directly related. The modern Western church, and by Western I mean, I don't know, kind of along the lines of like Europe and further west, technically it's probably through Constantinople, you draw that line, but that's a whole other thing, we're not going there. Jack is saying, yep. Ask him. We tend to be very confused when we talk about life after death. And the problem is we're confused and we don't know it. It is assumed that the Christian hope is that for those who die in Jesus, go to heaven. Like, that's not really even a question. But if you've spent some time reading the New Testament, especially, Old Testament has, like, almost no interest in what happens after you die. The New Testament has some, but not a lot. And when they do, when the writers do talk about that, they don't speak in the same terms that we do. So what happened? Well, that's for another time. It's what happens when certain philosophical ideas get mixed with the church. And I'm not saying that those who die in Jesus don't find themselves in the presence of God. I'm not saying that. Please don't throw things at me or write angry emails about that. But what I'm saying is that there's more to it, and that more to it really, really matters. So first off, yes, there is a sense in which upon death in Jesus, we find ourselves in his presence. But that's temporary. Because God, when he created humans, put them on earth. The earth is our home. It's where we belong. And if you trace the whole story of the Bible as one maybe multivocal sort of different perspective story, you'll find that it ends with God's presence coming to earth. That's Revelation 21. So what do we do with resurrection? What does that mean? Well, first off, Jesus was raised from the dead. And nobody expected that. Not even the people that he told multiple times. Because, shocker, they didn't get it. And the New Testament portion of the Bible is the aftermath of these apostolic inspired writers looking back and saying, we didn't see that coming. What do we do now? Because within Judaism, it's really the Pharisees and this other weird group in this area called Qumran. They believe that God would raise the dead someday in the future, and in doing so, he would vindicate Israel and reestablish the throne of David, kind of Messiah-type stuff, and all will be well for Israel. What nobody anticipated was that somebody was going to be raised ahead of time separately. And then you start getting these wild ideas from this guy named Paul, who himself was kind of a wild person. Things like, well, what God did for Jesus, he will do for us. Which raises the question, what did God do for Jesus? He raised him from the dead. What did that look like? He had a body. It had scars. It was continuous, or it had continuity with what went before him. Like, his scarred body was alive again, and he bore those scars, but they didn't seem to hurt anymore. Or if they did, he didn't complain. But then also, he was very weird, you know, kind of appearing before his disciples in a room full of locked doors. So if that's Paul's perspective, then we could say that God will raise us from the dead at some point. And in the meantime, Paul also says these wild, sort of strange things in the book of Romans, that creation itself is waiting for this moment. And he'll say in 1 Corinthians that in the context of resurrection, that the things we do, our labors, they're not in vain. Like, we're not wasting our time. Have you ever done a project and realized, wow, that was a significant waste of time, and I hate the result? This is basically home renovation 101 for me. Paul is saying that's not what happened. That there's going to be a moment where we look back and say, oh, this is why we were doing what we were doing. Now, it matters because if the story we are telling about ourselves, about creation, about this ongoing story of God and his people, and the point of that story is to get out of here. If the whole Christian narrative is about escape, for God to come and get me out of this mess and take me away so that I don't have to deal with all the icky stuff, then what we do here doesn't matter. Our story is one of escape. It kind of puts us on the continuum with Jim Jones, by the way, which let's not go there. And what happens here doesn't make a difference. But if the story is that God has placed us in our home, and as followers of Jesus, we are redeemed by him, baptized into his death, raised in new life as he's been raised from the dead, and therefore God has placed us in this moment at this time, And at some point in the future, we will look back, and as God raises us and creation from the dead and brings that new creation life to everything, and his presence comes and returns to earth, then what we do here in these moments matter. Our story isn't about escape. It's not about getting away from the disgusting realities of everyday life. It's not about getting away from the big bad government or whatever other entity you want to point out, or whatever entity you want to demonize or vilify. But rather, a Christian is called to engage, to bring justice, to bring peace, to bring mercy. Jesus called or said exactly this, but he used different words. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. You are a city set on a hill. Like, we get that in the moment, but if our story is, therefore, when we die, we can get out of here and we never have to deal with this again, then we can't really reconcile that and that. But if the story is you are taking part in finishing what God started when he raised Jesus from the dead, then what we do here really, really matters. Because if the story ends with God's presence returning to earth fully and completely, that interim space, which is where we are now, is all about us as temples of God, being houses of the Holy Spirit, are called to bring that new life everywhere we go, to everything we touch. So I would ask you, I mean, don't shout responses, that'll just be confusing. What does it look like to bring new creation everywhere we go? Or to use the words from the children's message, which, by the way, is actually ultimately stolen from J.R.R. Tolkien, what would it mean to bring that new reality where we go, where everything sad becomes untrue? What would that look like in your own heart? What if you engaged other people with this understanding that my job here is as an ambassador of this new creation? My job here is to leave the interactions that I have with people and creation itself, leaving it more merciful, more just, with more peace than it was before I got here. What would change? Because again, if our goal is just to get out of here, I'm a pretty selfish person. Then I don't care. But if God has placed us here in this moment for this reason, not only to proclaim, to announce that Jesus has been raised from the dead, but to actually live it, then what you do here matters. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't see anybody here who has changed the course of human history. At least not yet. I mean, you never know, but odds are not great. And yet at the same time, little changes tend to add up. Culturally speaking, depending on where you live, there's a narrative about being a stay-at-home mom, where somebody might say, "Oh, well, I'm just a stay-at-home mom," and I'm not saying that I agree with this in any shape, way, or form. Again, save your tomatoes for somebody else. Portions of American culture will say, well, that's kind of like the basic. That's the lower form of vocation or what you do with your time. Again, I don't agree. And yet, if we approach raising our children and nothing else, as though we are instilling into these children the fact that Jesus was raised from the dead, there will come a time when everything sad becomes unnew, and now your goal as children growing up into a world in desperate need is to be the presence of God, to bring justice, peace, and mercy everywhere you go, to bring that forgiveness that Jesus won, but also that real ingrained hope of possibility that God can redeem and transform anything dark and sad into something better and new. Good luck explaining that to a 9-year-old. And they grow up and enter the world firmly rooted in that hope that has a tendency to persist beyond all suffering. And then they go and start a family. And they have a couple of kids. Well, now what started as one becomes three. And then you impart that hope onto those three. Now three just became nine. you can see where I'm going with this. That it's not really the big things in life that call for resurrection hope. I mean, those do too. But most of our time is spent in the little, the everyday, the mundane, the boring. But that's exactly where we are called to bring resurrection. What does new life look for you in those small moments, those small interactions? The conversation you have with the checkout person at the grocery store, or with your aunt and uncle, or with your brother and sister, or your children, or your spouse, your boss, middle management who can't seem to make a right decision, or something. What does it look like to enter into that interaction with the hope that because Jesus has been raised from the dead, everything sad will become untrue. All of our darkness and struggle will be redeemed. And how can I bring that in this moment? I'm going to leave that one up to you. Because it's true. And it's also deeply personal. And it operates as both in both individuals and with communities. So then I'll raise another question. What does it look like for Christ Lutheran here in Albuquerque, both the church and the school, to live and be community together and educate children together and all of that, as though someday God will finish what he started in Jesus and this will be a part of it? What changes? What kind of hope can we have in situations that would otherwise feel hopeless? Because again, it's true. And so we will go out of here. We will engage with the world the rest of our week until we make our way back here. And my challenge to you is to enter into as many interactions and live out your vocation in whatever way that might look, with the sure and certain hope that God will raise the dead again, fully and completely, and he will start with where he left off with Jesus. So what does that look like? Amen. As you are able, please rise.